Excuse me. Hey, boys. Yeah, you. Yeah. Got something to say? Share it with the whole class.
Hi, everybody. Before I start, I want to apologize for some technical difficulties that come a little bit later in the show. At one point, relatively late, Daniel is talking and he gets cut off, and so we try to take a little while to try to get him back. So at that point, the show may be a little bit choppy, but we'll soldier on. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Back of the Class, a guide to education from the kids at the back of the class. We've got the usual crew with me tonight. My name is Patrick O'Shea. I'm an assistant professor of instructional technology at Appalachian State University. Joining me from the west coast of the U.S. is Simon Richmond, a technology associate at the Education Development Center. And joining me from the sunny clime of Newport News,
Peninsula.
Virginia, is Daniel Curry Corcoran, who is the apple of my eye. How you like them apples?
I love it.
Today we're going to try something a little bit different. Over the next few shows, what we're going to do is we're going to take each of us is going to take an opportunity to actually propose a solution to one of the topics that we've talked about over the past couple of years. Today that is going to be Simon. He's going to present a topic, and we're going to try to hammer out some of the details and how the project might be utilized on a wide scale. So take it away, Simon.
Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome, Simon.
So the issue that I've taken a lot of stick at from you two guys in the last couple of shows has been related to technology and how technology can be used in classrooms. And so I want to try and address this because obviously there's a huge amount of potential in technology, computers, for example, how they can be used to facilitate learning. But there's not a lot of very good practice happening in classrooms, not only in America, but worldwide. So I want to talk a few, go through a few principles that I think need to be considered when we're trying to design some kind of tech-based learning intervention. I've got five here, and once I go through these five, then we can talk about how we can transform these principles into practice and come up with solutions to how to better use computers in the classroom. So the first two relate to design. I'm assuming you guys are going to just interrupt me at any time if I'm not clear.
I know, we were doing a remarkably good job not interrupting you.
You're showing admirable self-restraint so far.
Yeah.
But yeah, feel free to jump in. I'm just going to go through this list, but if you need to interrupt me, feel free.
Absolutely.
Okay, good. So the first.
Can I say something real quick?
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm joking.
The first issue is that I think when trying to decide how to use tech in the classroom, you have to start with the problem that you're trying to solve. Don't start with the technology that you're trying to use. Don't try and figure out a way to use this new program that you've just learned about. It's much better to try and start with a challenge that your kids are facing. Here's a story to illustrate the point. I don't know if this is true or not, but I've heard it several times, so it must be. When they first invented computers, when they were, you know, the size of a room, the big mainframes, somebody did a survey of a potential market for this machine. Who could use a computer worldwide? You guys have heard this story, right?
Yes.
And the answer was something like six. There could potentially be six computers used worldwide.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that true?
I believe so, yes.
I've heard it a couple of times.
Yeah, so that has to be.
I've heard it at least once.
That's the kind of story that happens when you start with the technology and you start scratching your head saying, how could this be used? Who has the capacity to use this? And it's obviously backwards because we know the world needs a lot more than six computers. The proper question to have asked is, what problems do we have that this device could potentially solve? How could this device be adapted to solve some of our problems? So I don't think we should start by saying, how do we use computers in the classroom? We don't start by saying, how do we use computers to solve our literacy problems? That's how you end up designing literacy games for kids to play. What you should be asking is, what are the literacy problems my children are having? And that's when you might find out that it's not actually literacy games they need to be playing. It's because they don't have enough books at home. Mm-hmm. So bringing computers into the classroom isn't going to solve the fact that they don't have books at home to read with their parents. Starting with the problem takes you to an actual solution as opposed to, you know, a red herring computer being used in the back of the room. That's point number one.
Okay. Point number one.
Point number two.
Wait a minute. What was point number one?
Start with the problem.
He was too busy. He was too busy eating.
he's been made an apple of somebody's eye. He's just blissed out right now.
Yes, he is.
I am glitched out.
The second principle, also relating to design, is that when you bring a computer into use in your classroom, don't use it to improve. Use it to improve your practice. Don't use it to promote the status quo. Do something new with it. Don't do the old thing that you've already done before with it. For example, when TV was invented, they were really just taking radio shows and giving them a visual element. It was just talking head TV. They weren't taking advantage of the new power of TV. They were just doing what they already knew how to do, that was produce radio, and making it visual. So don't bring in a computer to the classroom and use it to give PowerPoint lectures, because you have a blackboard for that. And don't use it to digitize textbooks, because you already have textbooks. I mean, if you're going to digitize textbooks, put more multimedia resources into them to make them more powerful than the old textbooks. But then if you do that, figure out if they're going to be useful enough for kids to justify the extra expense. It would be better if you can do something with that computer that can't be done with a computer. In other words, don't continue the status quo, do something new. So computer games.
Can I make a recommendation real quick?
Sure, go ahead.
I think you should fast before every podcast.
He just said, don't use that computer to do something you could use a computer to do.
Did I?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think so far.
Oh, yeah. You all edited that out.
I don't have much to disagree with him on, and we're talking about technology. So
absolutely.
I'm a little struck.
No. Keep going.
Take it back. Keep going, please.
Keep going.
Keep more.
So an educational computer game is a great example. You can't do that without a computer. Getting students to create content, that's fantastic. You can't do that without multimedia resources. Getting them to gather unreachable resources. You could always send them to the library to research an encyclopedia. But they can use the internet to get a lot further. So those are good examples. But we're just scratching the surface here. Look at what's going on with social networking in young people. Why can't we tap into the amount of time they spend on Facebook and get that directed into communal group learning tasks to do homework? I mean, my daughter comes home and spends hours, or if I would let her, would spend hours on Facebook when she should be doing her homework. Can't she do that with friends? Can't we take some of the new powers of computers and funnel them into unimagined designs, educational designs? That's using computers intelligently. You're not promoting the status quo. You're designing new solutions. Now, I think that adoption of technology in classrooms is slow because we're not really using the tools to change the game. If we did, we would have more excitement among teachers. Now, third principle. Now we're talking about hardware. Computers are really complicated, and well-designed things can't very easily be broken. And that's kind of my principle. Break it first. As a teacher or as a designer of hardware, you need to break it first so that once you get into the hands of the kids, it can't be broken down further. Here's a story to illustrate the point.
I'm going to need a story to illustrate this point.
When we started using free play radios in the field, that's EDC, we were buying their first generation wind-up radio, and it had the same antenna you have on every other radio out there, a telescopic rod that collapses back into itself. And that was distributed in the numbers of thousands. But then the free play engineers went out, and when they redesigned the second model, they noticed what a huge number of those antennas had broken off. And the problem, they're fragile. They break off easily. The problem was that a villager out there who owns a radio and really cares for that radio can't very easily fix that broken antenna. You can't stick it back on. So what the engineers decided to do is, well, if they're going to break them, then why don't we break them first? So they threw out the telescopic design, and they replaced it with a wire. And they just literally bent the end of that wire and shoved it into a little metal tube, which was then wired into the circuitry inside the radio. So if the antenna broke or you lost that piece of wire, you could just replace it with a coat hanger, bend the tip and shove it back in the hole. It became unbreakable because they broke it first. Now, how do you relate that back to computers? Well, computers are extremely complicated. They're way more powerful than what we need them to be because they're designed to be multi-purpose devices. Taking a computer into a classroom to use it with your kids is a lot like showing up at a 7-Eleven that's just been robbed in like an aircraft carrier. You park your aircraft carrier out in the parking lot, and then you run in and you ask the clerks, can I get a copy of the videotape? And you get their little report, and you get back in your aircraft carrier, and you take off. There's way too much power in a computer, way more than you need for day-to-day classroom usage. And all that extra power...
Does an aircraft carrier
fly? The Canadian ones do.
That's why you never see them.
Yeah.
Stealth. Good. I'll talk that one up to the fast. Please, keep going.
Sorry. Keep going.
Now, we're starting to get into much more diversified hardware. There used to be desktops and there were laptops. Now there's netbooks and tablets, and the one laptop per child design is even simpler. So that's moving in the right direction. We're getting into devices that are custom designed for individual tasks. And I don't know why we don't have a North American designed computer for the classroom. If you got engineers together to make a really simple, cheap device, a lot like one laptop per child, I think there's a huge market for it. Let's look at the plague of computers everywhere. It's viruses, right? It's a huge job to stay on top of virus control. And the whole reason we have viruses is because computers are designed to do an infinite number of things. They're designed to run executable programs so that anyone can write one and then use a computer to run it. Well, why don't we redesign a computer that doesn't run executable programs? It sounds like a crazy idea, but we don't need it to run executable programs in a classroom. We need a controlled environment. We need a limited number of educational programs. So why don't we create one that just you can preload with content and then can't be broken? It's already been broken down to its simplest layer.
But how, in that case, how would you go about the production of stuff? How would you use that tool as anything more than a data access port, more than, if you want to create something using a video editing software, that's an executable program. You want to create something with word processing, that's an executable. How would you go about that?
I'm not saying it shouldn't run programs. Look at the iPad. There's no USB port. There's no Ethernet jack. There's no CD-ROM. There's no way to get external things on there except through the wireless antenna, and that comes through Safari. So you can load programs on, but only stuff that the App Store has approved. It's a closed model. And there's huge advantages to the open source one. But if you are in a classroom and you are a teacher, you know exactly what you need the kids to do. So why not preload a device with pre-approved programs and lock it down? I'm not a computer scientist, so I'm not sure that it's that hard to do, or even if it's that easy to do. But my point is, there's excess capacity in hardware design, and that capacity leaves loopholes that make it difficult for a teacher to use their devices. They need to be a master of the hardware, and that hardware is very nebulous.
Okay, I can buy that. I can dig it.
The second point, and this may be an extension of the same principle, again related to hardware, good hardware is invisible. By that I mean the user is unconscious when they're using it. They don't realize what they're doing. When I'm at work, I don't pause my working day and then say, I'm going to go use the computer now. I'm going to have some computer time. I mean, the computer is an integrated part of my day. I'm on it and I'm off it, but it's never a conscious transition between the two. Working overseas, in Africa in particular, I see it in a lot of bureaucrats' offices, senior government people's offices. They have two desks. There's their work desk, and then pushed to the wall is the computer desk. And that's really the old way of doing things. You separate the two. If you are really fluent with your device, it's right there in front of you, and it's like using the microwave. You don't think to yourself, I'm going to go use the microwave now. You think to yourself, I'm hungry. And you just accomplish the task that you're trying to accomplish. It's not a big... The tech is invisible to you.
Okay.
Now, as an illustration of that, everyone likes to talk about cell phones, the huge penetration they have in the developing world. And the reason that has been accomplished is because you just talk on a phone. It's just a natural human thing. It's the phone is invisible during your conversation. The radio is invisible during the act of listening. We need computers to become invisible behind the act of learning. We need to become so easy. They need to become so easy to use, and we need to become so familiar with them that we forget that we're using them. And digital natives are already doing that. Our kids are already doing that. But a majority of teachers out there are still nervous about it because they're not comfortable with the technology. Probably simply because it's not old enough. Now, the last principle is relating to human ability. And what it comes down to is that we need to build human capacity first. Human capacity before technical capacity. We can teach anybody how to use a computer, but in actual fact, it's what they do with the computer once they know how to move the mouse and turn it on that's important. And those are the skills which are much more complicated to give somebody. There's a computer scientist, I think he's out of Berkeley, named Toyama, who likes to talk a lot about the experience he used to have with Microsoft and telecenters in India. When these telecenters went in, bringing, you know, e-government to the rural poor, bringing all kinds of new information services, there was a lot of excitement that this was going to transform their lives. But what he noticed very quickly was that all they were really being used for was to check out horoscopes, to download ringtones, and to view adult content, young men coming in and viewing adult content.
Where was this again?
Telecenters in India.
Okay.
And I think that's true of, I mean, I saw telecenters in Malawi that were like that as well. People use the internet to access what they're interested in, what they need to get. And what we assume is that every person has the ability to ask questions and seek out answers. And that may not necessarily be the case. What you have to have is the human capacity to use the machines. So you hear a lot about cell phones and using mobile technology to learn market prices. Rural farmers want to learn what the cost of crops are in town. Well, that's a fantastic example. That's relevant information to them. They need that immediately. And so it's very easy to explain to them how to use a phone because they have a motivation to gather that information. But if you try and take that rural farmer's, you know, 10th grade son and explain to him that he can also use his phone to watch an animation of some moon orbiting Jupiter, that's not relevant information to his daily needs. He may not have the capacity to ask the questions or to appreciate how this information is going to serve his life. It may not serve his life. The point Toyama makes is that adding computers into a society doesn't automatically grant them capacity. It's not an additive power. If they have X and you add computers, they no longer have computers, X plus computers. What computers do is they multiply the capacity that already exists. So if you don't have constructivist learning in a classroom already, you're not going to get it by adding computers. You're just going to have multiplied this new computer skill, these new computer tools, by the zero skill that was there. It's multiplication by zero. You need to start by building the child-centered teaching practices first, and then slowly introducing the hardware so that it takes advantage of the capacity that's already there. If you just focus on teaching the technical skills, a lot of research shows that you're terrifying teachers, because it takes them 15 hours to learn how to use the device. They assume they're going to have to dedicate another 15 hours to teach it to their kids. And then after that's done, they're not even really sure what to do with it.
All right, so let me ask this question. As Daniel said, there's nothing here that I would disagree with. What I would be interested in hearing is, what's the end game with these 5 points? What's the end goal look like? Are we talking about the development of a device? Are we talking about a training protocol? What are we talking about as a service or a product that could be delivered to people?
Well, that was the question I was trying to answer for myself as I came up with this list. And what I have to acknowledge is that it's happening already. All of these things are slowly being solved just with the passage of time. I think if we were going to speed it up, the most practical solution we could do is probably to ban computers from the classroom. Just make it illegal for them to be used. I mean, that's the fastest way to get something to take on, right? To take off.
I think they're doing that in Wisconsin.
I mean, the digital natives are growing up. The kids that are graduating with teacher certificates now, they know how to use computers. They've been growing up with them. The computer is an invisible device to them. So that one's been accomplished.
See, but that doesn't necessarily mean that those people who have the computer or whatever device is invisible to them, it doesn't mean that they can do new things with them. There's a disconnect there that I would be looking for a solution to. You know, your second point is, you know, don't use the computers to do the status quo. Do something new. This is the same thing that the guy's name is his. Completely lost
Bill?
To me.
No. Bill Robertson?
Will Ferrell.
It'll come to me. He's been talking about doing that as well. Do different things, don't do the same things you've always done differently. That's what I'd be looking for.
Well,
that's for me. I mean, we have a lot of. I'm sorry. Were you finished?
No, go ahead, Dan.
I cut you off. Huh?
Go ahead. I've been talking a lot. Take the floor.
Well, one of the things that I've seen, and I think, you make some very lucid points. I mean, not that you don't always, but I mean, nothing that I would have expected as soon as the word technology comes out of your mouth to disagree with you. But I mean, we can all be surprised, right? One of the things that I think we see a lot of, I'm always kind of a little bit perplexed that. We have a lot of, let's say academics or even practitioners who have gotten out of education or out of K-12, and then they have all these great ideas, right? And they travel the country speaking about these very points, you know? But for some reason, we in K-12 are not able to internalize these practices in the classroom. And I think sometimes it comes down to we're just making some bad decisions, you know? I mean, ever since, you know, we did have this idea of having computers in the classroom, right? It's kind of like, oh, if you put three computers in the classroom, they will come, right? And what they did, I think it gets to the model that Simon discussed, you know, maybe that some of the expats, you know, in Africa, where, you know, they have the computer and it's in the back of the class and, you know, from time to time it's used as a resource, but it's not a part of their everyday. So I think one of the things we really don't have, and I think, you know, Patrick and I are working on a project at Newport News, is we don't really have a concise plan, a concise training plan on how to actually make it happen. And the reason I say that is because one of the things that, you know, I found when I was doing my doctoral research, and again, Simon, I think you were down in Brunswick from time to time, and I know Pat was a technology.
Did you just call it Brunswick?
Yeah, he did.
Did I say Brunswick? It wasn't it. Whack. It was Brunswick. The old Brunswick stew, which I never had when I was down there. But, I mean, what did we find with we had a field-based master's program. So here we actually have a way of for teachers to participate in professional development that's not a one-off training, and where they get to actually engage in this professional development over time. So they're learning as we were learning. And one of the things I think we found that when we focused on what I think Simon was saying we shouldn't, where, you know, you're focused on, oh, I got this document camera.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm still here. Is he gone?
I think Daniel's gone. Hold on a second.
As he said, document camera, he pressed the button.
As he should be. All right. Let me try adding him back in. So while that's dialing Daniel in, hopefully he'll answer.
Mm.
I think that what he's trying to talk. Let's see if this.
He just got sniped.
He did.
Yeah. Somebody slit his throat.
Yikes.
The murderer is looking at the phone ring, trying to decide whether he should answer. It's probably Jason.
Is this Daniel? Hello?
Hi, you've reached 757-968.
We won't put his whole phone number out there on the internet. Well, here's what, since we're not probably going to be able to get Daniel back in time to wrap this up, I think that this whole thing gets back to the idea of doing things differently. The anecdote that Daniel was talking about was the idea that we started out that field-based master's with the idea of just teaching how to make the technology function, how to turn things on, how to, you know, and providing them computers. And, you know, after a while, I guess that's kind of where you have to start with people. But after a while, we switched our methodology and we were getting people into small groups so that they chose whatever technology they were going to work with. And their task was to find educational ways to make it do the things they wanted it to do in their classrooms. And that's when the field-based masters really took off. And I think it speaks to, I think it really does speak to Simon's point about giving people an opportunity to see the end in the beginning. That's his first point. Start out with the idea of what you want it to do first, and then find the tool, and then learn the tool in that setting. Personally, I think that all of these are really good points. I think what it really yearns for is some kind of organized approach to tackling these issues, and a desire to figure out what's more important, the technology or the training or the pedagogy, and focus some attention not only locally, but on larger scales on those things. And that's kind of what I've been trying to do with the project that we've been working on in Newport News, Daniel and I, trying to use this project as a means to find out what it takes to teach people about augmented reality, which is what the project's about.
Mm.
But that's where I really think the power is getting teachers to really understand the flexibility of the approach to answering, teaching issues that they have to address, whether it's content provision or classroom management, student engagement, motivation, all of those other things. You start looking at those as the problems that you're approaching, and you try to find ways to answer those approaches. Hold on. I'm going to pause this.
These kinds of training problems out there. And the point I want to reinforce that you just made is that your field-based master's program got a lot better the very moment that you started applying the high-end educational principles that you wanted the teachers to apply.
Right.
And that's the secret to a lot of success.
Well, the reason that I would disagree with what you've said is I don't think we would have gotten to that point without going through that first stage.
Oh, yeah, there's learning.
Yeah,
everyone's learning this stuff all the time.
Well, one of the biggest and most important learning experiences that I had in the whole field-based master's project was taking an old computer into the big classroom and giving volunteers a chance to break it, you know, because there was such a fear of doing anything with the technology because they were going to, quote unquote, break the machine, and it was an expensive machine and they didn't want to be responsible for that. And so I took an old computer in and I said, here's your opportunity. Take 5 minutes, do what you can, delete files, do whatever you want. And, you know, a couple of people took me up on it, and they kind of saw firsthand that they weren't able to break the machine by just pushing the wrong button.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a MacGyver episode where you push the red button and the thing explodes. It doesn't really happen very often. But they needed to see that firsthand. That allowed them a comfort with the device to kind of get beyond the fear of turning the thing on, which allowed us to build up to that. So I guess it's more of a process for me of working with teachers and making sure that they have the foundational elements so that they can progress.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just touch on the solution here that we've worked out at EDC. And that is, it's training. Okay. You can't avoid the fact that a lot of teachers out there, they need a well-designed training. Mm-hmm. And what we found is working for us in India and also in Indonesia is blending a combination of online tutorials with face-to-face coaching. And that is then combined with some very simple, easy-to-use lesson plans that revolve around a technology like a laptop that are incrementally increased in complexity. Mm-hmm. So a teacher sits down with a learning partner. They go through a series of lessons. They get a lot of classroom coaching from trained staff within their school, and then they're given a device to start using in their classroom. And it works. It's laborious and it's carefully designed, but it's like my uncle says. He's a veteran teacher himself. I've sat through so many professional development sessions, and I've heard good ideas told to me, and I've said to myself in the back of the room, "Oh yeah, that's a good idea. I'll try that with my kids." And then 2 years later, I'll be in another one, and I'll hear the same idea mentioned again, and I'll go, "Oh yeah, that's right. I remember that. I should do that one day." He's noticed it takes about 3 times before he actually tries something on his own.
Right.
And he's a very dedicated professional. So it's difficult to change people's behavior. But a carefully designed training program can do it. Mm-hmm. If you have the right combination of baby steps, social support, as well as online content.
Okay. Are there any links to documents or the proofs of concept that I could put on the blog when I post that?
I don't think so. At this point, I'm trying to finish up a summary of those two projects. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing finished, but.
Okay. Well, we can revisit that at some point. I think that it'll be good to kind of to show the pudding where the proof is. You know what I mean?
Sure.
All right. Well, I think that's a good place to stop because it brings us full circle back to a kind of a concrete solution to this as well, which is what I would like the podcast to be about, is talking about solutions to these things rather than just bitching about the problems. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So with that, we're at 34 minutes, and I'll say thank you, Simon. Sorry for Daniel with his technical problems, but I'm sure he'll join us next week and have plenty to say about it. So I want to thank everybody for those people who have decided to follow us. As always, we can be found on iTunes by searching for The Back of the Class, and we can be reached via email at thebackoftheclass@yahoo.com. We also have the blog. That's thebackoftheclass.blogspot.com, where that's where we'll be linking to things like what Simon has described here, and just talking about the issues that we've talked about. We'd love to hear your comments there. I'd like to thank the kids at the back of the class, Daniel, Simon. Thanks for being here.
Thanks very much, Patrick.
You're welcome. Bye.